Welcome back to Wednesday Night Bible Study. I'm Richard Meservey, and we are in the middle of the vision of Isaiah. Sorry the stream didn't work last week. Hope it works better tonight. And it is recorded, so you can go back and catch up if you want. We are a couple stops away from the first main break in Isaiah. So when we get to chapter 39, which will be at the end of next week, we'll take a break from Isaiah to spend 8 weeks on the book of Colossians, which is a change of pace. And then a special treat after Colossians, I forget if it's 3 weeks or 4 weeks, Pastor Sean will be doing something, and I'm not sure what it's going to be. So we have lots of good stuff to look forward to, and then eventually, I know, don't panic, we will get back to the rest of Isaiah at some point. But from 40 to 66, we've been looking at light over darkness and mostly darkness. And then once in a while, the light will break through. But from 40 to 66, it's kind of the reverse. It's a lot of light, and still he reminds us that we're still living in times of darkness. So we're looking at, we've gone over the outline of Isaiah, the branch, Zion, present and future, Book of Oracles we looked at, chapters 13 through 23, where God showed himself supreme over all the nations. He judges the entire earth. And then we've been looking at 28 through 39 is the folly of putting trust in the nations. And in that, we looked at fools and the consequences for their foolishness, the foolish choice, the end of foolishness we saw when we see the king in his beauty. And last week, we looked at the vengeance of the Lord and the return of the ransom to full worship and enjoyment of life in him. From 36 to 39, focuses on the king Hezekiah. And tonight we'll look at Hezekiah and the Assyrian king Sennacherib. And next week we'll look at Hezekiah and his illness and then the transition to Babylon. So right now Isaiah is dealing with Assyria as the worst enemy, but the day will come when Babylon will be. So last week, quick review from chapter 34 through 35 is the great alternative, and we saw the destruction of God, a slaughter, a sacrifice. We saw him undoing creation, undoing civilization, even a reference to Noah's Ark, that there's animals with a mate, but there are no people. There's a destruction of all humanity and a destruction of the land. And then we turned the corner in chapter 35, and we saw the wilderness, the desert, blooming. There's water, there's refreshment, there's joy, and the coming salvation, and eventually a highway of holiness where the people of God come to Mount Zion, worshiping him in joy and in celebration. So that was the choice that we saw last week. The alternative of taking the way of the world, ending in destruction, or serving the true God, ending in life. The values that Isaiah drives home in the last several chapters, he does again tonight. Only now it's in like a concrete example of, so he's been telling us, don't trust the nations. If you do, this is what's going to happen. But if you don't, then this is what's going to happen. And Hezekiah is now facing that very choice. So the question is in chapter 36, will the Lord deliver Jerusalem from the Assyrians? The Assyrians have come. They've conquered city after city after city in Israel and then in Judah. And now the question, you remember that the people of Judah, the leaders went to Egypt to try to get help from Egypt. And Isaiah said, this is a good idea, bad idea, men's idea. No, it's like it's a bad idea. It's exactly what you don't want to do. So now the question is, well then, will the Lord deliver Jerusalem? And the answer is, chapter 37, yes. Question is, the historical record, do any gods defeat the Assyrians as they march through? And the answer is, the Lord is not just any other God. But we're going to see Sennacherib's view is, you know, I have conquered all these gods, all these kings, all these cities. What makes you think that you'll be any different? And what makes us think that we'll be different is, in 37, 35, the Lord says, I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. And that makes the difference. All the gods fail before the Assyrian power, but this God does not fail. He has a purpose. So, quick review, and now we'll turn to chapter 36. Unless you had things that you thought of during the week or now that raised a question or something that you wanted to share. All right, chapter 36, verses 1 through 3 is the setting. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh, which is like chief official, from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem with a great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. And there came out to him Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. That's the setting. Was there anything in there that reminded you of something that we've seen in Isaiah before? It's a very dangerous question. I did? Oh, yeah. You're reading ahead. What was the answer? What answer did I give you?
You talked about Ahaz in chapter 7.
Right, and where did Isaiah challenge Ahaz in chapter 7? It was at this very place where the water, he was inspecting the water supply. So think, an army takes you to siege. They surround the city, they block the gates. You can't go in, you can't go out. And if it lasts long enough, you run out of food and you run out of water. But Hezekiah built a tunnel from the spring Gihon outside the city walls into Jerusalem so that it was within the city. Now, they could still run out of food if they didn't stock up, but he prepared for this. Now, the problem is that in one point in Isaiah, he said, you guys have, you've got your water, you enforced the walls, you counted the houses, you did all this stuff, but you didn't ask the one that is leading. You didn't ask God. So the question is going to be, is Hezekiah any different from Ahaz? And that's what these chapters are about. Hezekiah as opposed to Ahaz. We also saw Shebna. Remember, Shebna was, he was the chief guy. And Isaiah said, you know, you're going to come down a peg, and then Eliakim will take your place, but he is a weak peg, and he won't be able to hold anything up. And that these are the ones that, that we're talking about. So that's a picture from in Jerusalem, the tunnel that Hezekiah made. You can walk through and wade through the water as you go through. And there's a sign the archaeologists found that tells about the workmen and how they came, and they could hear the workmen on the, you know, they're coming from both ends, and then, you know, then they can hear the people working on the other side, and they break through. But that's Hezekiah, and Sennacherib is the king, and he attacks and conquers the cities of Judah. And in fact, there's a the archaeologist has found documents from Assyria, and one of them is Sennacherib's discussion of his warfare in Judah. And he says, as for Hezekiah, the Judean, I besieged 46 of his fortified walled cities and surrounded smaller towns, which were without number, using packed-down ramps and applying battery rams, infantry attacks by mines, breaches, siege machines. I conquered them. And he himself, that is Hezekiah, I locked up within Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. That he, you know, he's bragging about what he did to Hezekiah, but he doesn't say he conquered the royal city, which is unusual, because you would think if he failed, he would lie. But he doesn't have it on there. He conquers all these cities. He has Hezekiah locked in a siege, but then, as we'll see, the Lord does deliver the city and sets them free. So now he's at Jerusalem, and he has his leaders then talk to the people of Jerusalem. And that's in verse 4 through 10. So when I read this, though, be listening for things that the enemy says that Isaiah has been already saying, but nobody will listen to them. So in verse 4, and Rabshakeh said to them, say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you're trusting in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust him. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I'll give you 2,000 horses, if you're able on your part to set riders on them. How can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Moreover, is it without the Lord that I have come up against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. So what did you see in here that Isaiah has already been saying?
Don't trust Egypt.
Don't trust Egypt. So here's the enemy saying, are you so stupid that you're going to trust Egypt? And how does he describe Egypt? A what? What kind of reed?
Broken.
Yeah. A broken reed. And what happens if you're trying to put your weight on a... Yeah, it's worse than useless. It's actually injurious. It's going to injure you if you try to depend on them. What else did you see in here?
Hezekiah had destroyed all the altars to the false god of Baal and others. And he's saying, he took them all around. Those gods aren't going to protect you now.
Yeah, and not only the false gods, but the high places where they would worship the true God, but in the inappropriate way, he took those down. And so, Sennacherib saying, I don't know how the Lord is going to, answer your prayers because you took down all the altars to him. And don't trust this Hezekiah. He's leading you down the wrong road. What else?
He mocks them. And in the New Living it says, with your tiny army, how can you think of challenging even the weakest contingent of my master's troops? He's just belittling them.
Yeah, it's really condescending and insulting. In fact, if you notice, it says, say to Hezekiah. He doesn't say to King Hezekiah. It's like, just say to Hezekiah. I mean, compared to me, the great king, he's nothing and nobody. And he's going to pay for his crime. So here, the enemy is saying the same thing that Isaiah has been saying. Who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust in your God as opposed to Sennacherib? Or are you going to trust in Egypt? Or are you going to trust in your armies and cavalry? All of them, every other city has failed. So what makes you think you'll be able to? And did you notice how many times it talked about words in here? Throughout this whole section, this in the next section as well, it's always the words of Hezekiah, the words of Isaiah, or the words of Sennacherib. The only word that really counts is the word of God. And that's what Hezekiah is going to find out. So whose power? Can you depend on Egypt? It's a broken reed. You'll be destroyed if you trust them. And your army will be worthless. And really, can you depend on the Lord's will? And this is really going to the heart. Because notice what he said. Who did he give credit for conquering the cities that he conquered?
The Lord.
It's what?
The Lord.
The Lord.
See, the Lord was helping them.
Yeah. And, Isaiah has said the same thing, didn't he? Remember way back, the Lord said, I'll whistle for these soldiers from Assyria to come and bring judgment on my people. And here he's saying the same thing, that it's because of the Lord. He's saying that the Lord is sovereign and his providential guidance is bringing victory. I think it's John Oswalt that said, sometimes it's only our enemies who see the true folly of our behavior. I mean, that's embarrassing, right? When people that oppose the Lord look and point and say what you're doing that's inconsistent with what you believe. So here, we'll find out, he's not really trusting the Lord. He's just trying to get them to surrender. But the very fact that he can quote Isaiah's theology better than the people that dwell there is embarrassing, and it goes on. Anything else you saw in there that either Isaiah said or something that needs to be pointed out? Well, he already takes a breath, and then he continues on with more of the challenge in 11 through 20. And here again, listen to what he wants them to conclude after he finishes talking. Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joab said to the Rabshakeh, "Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people on the wall." Now, why would they say that?
Because they didn't want the people to get afraid.
Yeah, exactly. They say, you know, we'll just talk leader to leader, but don't talk and demoralize the people that are listening in. And but verse 12, but Rabshakeh said, "Has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and drink their own urine?" I mean, this is, please don't let them understand, don't let them hear what you're saying. But he's got a warning for everybody. What is this expecting the people to say? It's not worth it. This is going to be really bad. I'm going to just go ahead and yield to them. Then verse 13, Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice. So no more whispering between the leaders. In a loud voice, "Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you." And this whole chapter is going to be about deliverance over and over and over again. Don't let him deceive you. He will not be able to deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord by saying, "The Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, "Make your peace with me and come out to me. Then each one of you will eat of his own vine and each one of his own fig tree, and each one of you will drink the water from his own cistern." So what is he saying here?
He's undermining Hezekiah's authority still as the king.
Yeah. Don't let him deceive you. Yeah. He's not going to deliver you. And then what does he offer them?
Fruit and wine.
Yeah.
If they surrender to him.
Drink. If you maintain what you're doing, as said in verse 12, you'll eat your own dung, drink your own urine. But if you come out and surrender, then each one of you will drink from your own vine, and you'll eat from your own fig tree. You'll have your own cistern with your own water. That sounds like a pretty good deal, doesn't it? Here's my choice. Siege, starvation, or just good living, the life of Riley. And in fact, now, have you heard that before? Each one will eat his own vine and each one his own fig tree. Have you heard that before? This was a promise of God. In Micah 4:4, it says, "They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. The mouth of the Lord has spoken." So here, the enemy is quoting the promises of God and saying, Hezekiah can't deliver you, but I can deliver these promises to you. Your choice, starvation in the siege of the city, or come out and go into exile. Because as he goes on and says, verse 17, "Until I come and take you away to a land like your own," right? Taking away, it's just as good, maybe even better. But what's the problem with that? Take you to a land not your own. Your captive And what?
You'll be enslaved.
You'll be enslaved, and you'll be living
your home.
Not in the land that God gave them. It's a, you know, that's, you know, maybe it would be even a good thing. Own vine, own fig tree, own cistern. Life is pretty good, but it's not the promised land. And so until I take them, you'll have grain, wine, land of bread and vineyards. I mean, it's the typical carrot and stick, right? The stick is, if you say no, then judgment comes to that city. You're starving, eating your own dung, drinking your own urine. Or the carrot, you can have your own cistern, you can have your own vineyard, you can have your own fig trees. It's all going to be good. And so he goes on, verse 18. Therefore, beware lest Hezekiah mislead you. Right? It's all about what Hezekiah is promising. And Hezekiah says that the Lord will deliver us. And now he gets to the point. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Have any of the gods succeeded in stopping the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Where have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Even Israel did not get delivered when Assyria came to attack. Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? I mean, it's a good question, isn't it? What makes you think that the Lord will protect this city when he gave all these other cities, 46 walled cities of Judah that he took? Maybe he lied a little bit and embellished, but he took a lot of them. And now it's down to Jerusalem. What God has stopped me? What God or king has stopped me? And so this now, he's moving from questioning Hezekiah to questioning the Lord. Right? These gods can't stop me, neither can your God. And that's a different, now he's treading on thin ice, right? It's one thing to mock the people and Hezekiah and the rest of it, but now he's saying that these other gods, they can't stop me, and your God can't stop me either. And he's right. He's right unless the Lord determines to protect this city. What is it? Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds a house, those that build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman that stays awake, it's in vain. It's worthless. If the they're in a position now where it's either conquered by Assyria or God fights for them. There's no third. They're not going to negotiate themselves out of this mess. It's going to be either Assyria or the Lord will act. And that's the challenge all the time, isn't it? I mean, we face crises and maybe don't see a way out and don't know how we'll survive. And the temptation is, well, what does the world tell me to do? How can I get out of this on my own? Or can I trust the Lord to deliver? That's the question that they're facing. That's what we've been seeing in Isaiah for 36 chapters. Trust the Lord. He is faithful. Turn to him. Everything else will fail. turn to him. And that, so now the question is, Ahaz didn't. Will Hezekiah? Will Hezekiah follow the advice and the theology of Isaiah? Verse 21. But they were silent and answered him not a word. Probably a good choice, right? You're not gonna argue your way out of this. For the king's command was, do not answer him. And then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna, the secretary, Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, they came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of Rabshakeh. In chapter 37, as soon as King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. What is Hezekiah's response?
Humbling himself before the Lord.
Yeah, how do you know that?
Because it said he tore his clothes and covered himself with...
Tore his clothes, put on sackcloth. And it doesn't mention ashes, but it would be appropriate. And then, where does he go?
To the temple.
To the house of the Lord.
He goes to the house of the Lord. Right? Doesn't escape through the tunnel to get to, get counsel in Egypt, right? He goes to the house of the Lord. And he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and the senior priest, covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos. And they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this is a day of distress, of rebuke, and disgrace. Now, I kind of have to chuckle a little bit. Because you remember how long they told Isaiah, tell us smooth things. Don't tell us this. Stop talking to us about the Holy One of Israel, right? Well, now all of a sudden, we want to hear from Isaiah because everything else has failed. And I don't know about you. I can relate to this because how many times have you tried everything and then say, well, I might as well do it God's way because nothing else is working. You know, instead of just doing that first, it's like, okay, I tried this, I tried that, I tried the other thing. None of it's working, so maybe God has a better way of doing it. And this is a day of disgrace. Children have come to the point of birth and there's no strength to bring them forth. Can anybody relate to that?
That would be terrible.
You think the labor is bad, but you know, before they had the concept of a C-section, you lose the ability, you lose all
total
strength.
Exhaustion.
And what happens?
Total exhaustion.
And then you die.
And
baby dies, and you die. And Hezekiah is saying, that's what we're like. We're like a woman in labor who has gone through however many hours and now is so exhausted, no child can come. We're helpless. We're helpless. So here you have Sennacherib can boast, I've got armies, I've got cavalry, I've got 46 cities that I have conquered. I'm fighting with Egypt. They're all falling beside me. Every king, every god, I have it all. And Hezekiah says, and we have nothing. We can't beat him. We're helpless. Unless, verse 4, it may be that the Lord your God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke the words that the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. So this is not Ahaz. This is Hezekiah, a godly king. He goes to the temple. He humbles himself. He requests help from Isaiah. He doesn't even demand anything, does he? He says, maybe the Lord will answer, asking for prayer. And I think more than anything else, he's offended by the mocking of the Assyrians, to mock the true God, the living God. Will God put up with that? And then he has a concern for the destiny of the people. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. The faithfulness of God, the character of God, the promises of God, all of this is at stake if he doesn't act in our behalf. We can't make him. It's not the repentance. It's not the humility. It's God being true to his own character that is the solution. What else do you see in there?
The Lord tells Isaiah what his plan is going to be.
Did you read on ahead?
Don't confuse me now. You know?
Yeah, we're gonna get there.
I'm assuming this is true because you see it all over the place, so nothing on the internet is ever wrong, right? And I see it, you know, in like constant business books and everything else, but they say that the Chinese symbol for crisis is made up of two signs: danger and opportunity. Danger and opportunity, or a time of change. And that's kind of what Hezekiah is facing, isn't it? This is a crisis, and it's a threat. It's danger, but it's also an opportunity for him to shine, and more importantly, for the Lord to shine. And you know, maybe that's the way we should look at when crises come. Is a chance for God to reveal himself, and it's a chance for our character to grow and be revealed. And this is not Ahaz. Remember, Ahaz, Isaiah said, pick a sign. He said, I don't want to, right? Because then, you know, it was kind of like, then I'll be shown to be, you know, unfaithful. But here, God is going to give him a sign freely because his heart is turned to him. And then that leads us to 5-7, the Lord's response. When the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, Isaiah said to them, it's like he didn't even have to intercede. He already knew the answer, right? Thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words you have heard with which the young men of the king of Assyria have reviled me. "Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his own land." It's no problem at all. You know, I'm thinking, you know, it's like, you know, a fly in the paper. I just flick it off. Sennacherib, boasting, braggart, all this power, people are afraid, and the Lord says, he'll just hear a rumor and go back home. Not to worry, and then he'll die there. And that's, you know, I remember that movie. See, I can never remember which Apollo flight it was, but the one where Tom Hanks is, and they're trying to get back home because they, you know, something went wrong, and you know they're all there in the room trying to figure out how to get out, and the one guy says, "I think this will be NASA's finest hour," and that's Hezekiah here. It's his finest hour when it's desperately treacherous. He rises to the occasion, and he puts his faith in the true God. So that should end the story, but it doesn't. So in verse 8, so for some reason, speculation is Sennacherib is leading the armies all the way down Syria, through Israel, through the towns of Judah, on his way down to battle Egypt. Doesn't want a two-front war, Egypt and then Jerusalem between them. So if he can conquer one and then come back, but he doesn't want Hezekiah to think, "I guess I've won." You know, he's leaving. So instead, he sends him a letter. It sends him a letter saying the same things, only more so. Now, we used to have to do this when we talk to a customer. We would always follow it up with an email and say, because it's too easy to say, "I didn't say that," or, you know, is here, "Hezekiah, don't think that because I'm leaving, I'm not gonna come back. It's this letter is." Well, it's in the voice. I'm reading it in the voice of Arnold Schwarzenegger. "I'll be back." You know, that's what the letter is in verse 8. Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, for he had heard that the king had left Lachish. Now the king heard concerning Tirhakah, king of Cush. He set out to fight against you, and when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, verse 10, "Thus you shall speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands, devoting them to destruction. And shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them? The nations that my fathers destroyed, Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, and the people of Eden who were in Telassar. Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of the Sepharvaim, and the king of Hena, or the king of Iva?" So the point here is, no God has stopped me. No king has stopped me. And notice, in the first one, he said, "Don't let Hezekiah deceive you." Who does he say, "Don't let deceive you" here? Yeah, don't. So it's bad enough, Hezekiah, don't let him deceive you. But now he says, "Don't let your God deceive you. He is not able to defend you. He's not able to protect you. Don't let him talk you into it." And this is, I mean, this is really arrogant. This is the kind of arrogance that if God was going to wink at, you know, what you're doing, he's not going to now. And that's, you know, he writes the letter, your God's a deceiver. I put the nations under the ban. Same thing that God said he was going to do. Your God cannot deliver you. No gods deliver their nations. This is the peacock strutting around, showing his plumage, bragging about who he is. Proverbs 16:8. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. The arrogance, it might intimidate the people, and it might get people to admire him, but it doesn't with God. And Isaiah himself said in chapter 10, shall the axe boast over him who hews with it, or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it? The fact is that the Lord did give him success, but now he acts like it's his own, and it isn't his own. And then Hezekiah gets the letter in verse 14. Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord. Again, he went up to the house of the Lord. And he spread it out before the Lord. And then he prayed. So he did it once. The threat is still there. And he does it again. And now listen to the prayer and begin to ask yourself, what makes it a great prayer? O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O God, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are the Lord. All right, what makes this a great prayer?
It's a desperate prayer.
It's,
and it's a sincere prayer.
Desperate, sincere.
He even admits what Sennacherib had been saying. They could take them, you know.
Yeah. He's not covering up or embellishing.
He's telling the truth.
But he's coming to the obvious conclusion that you alone are God. The others are false.
Yeah. I mean, what did Sennacherib say? All these gods failed.
They burned them up.
Burned them. And Hezekiah said, yep. They did. Burned them up. But what's the problem with those gods?
They were made from men's hands.
Yeah, they're not God. Right? They're
wood and stone, false gods.
Wood, stone, false god?
He says that God is the God that created the heavens and the earth. The other gods couldn't do that.
No. The other gods were created, and not only created, but created by men's hands. The very men that are putting their trust in them. I've told this story before.
I only know so many things, so I have to say it again. That missionary goes to a place where they're worshiping idols, and there's one guy there that doesn't worship idols. He said, "Well, how come you don't worship these idols?" He said, "Well, I used to make the idols." And then one day I thought, why should I worship this thing that I made? I'm going to worship the one that made this hand. Well, that's brilliant. Hezekiah gets that. Right? Sennacherib doesn't get that. And it's going to cost him. So here's the prayer. Again, he goes to the house of the Lord. But he prays from the foundation of who the Lord is. He is the true God, the creator God, the living God, the one that hears, the one that sees. The idols, they have ears, but they don't hear. They have eyes, but they don't see. See, hear, and act. The one true God, the creator and ruler of earth. And where does he say he was enthroned? Above the cherub. Now, what is that a reference to?
In the Holy of Holies.
But also the vision that Isaiah had at the very beginning of his call from God.
Yeah, he doesn't mention the cherubim. He mentioned the seraphim. And they were probably there too. But I think all this is in the Holy of Holies, you have this Ark of the Covenant. And over it are the cherub. And enthroned on top of them is the God who has determined that he would dwell
in Jerusalem. That he would dwell in this temple. That's where he would dwell. And then Hezekiah prays to the one that is enthroned as the covenant-keeping God of Israel. He has made a covenant with them to keep them as his people, and as he says, David as his son. He sees, he hears, and he acts. He's the living God. And this God will not be mocked. It might look like we can mock him and get away with it, but he won't. He won't be mocked. But he will be known. What does he say? That you might... So now, O Lord, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are the Lord. That it's the revelation of who God is. That's the foundation of a great prayer. Who God is, what his will is. And that's what Hezekiah praise on the basis of who God is and what he wants to do. And what else is important in there?
Not only will he deliver his people, but those that are not his people will see them delivered.
Yeah.
So they will know he's the true God too.
And, just think,
I just read A.W. Tozier's The Purpose of Man. And he said the purpose of man is to worship the Creator. And he bemoaned the fact that in many churches, the people that direct the affairs of the church are not worshipers. They're maybe great financial business people, a lot of savvy, but they don't worship the true God. And here, Hezekiah, this is the kind of king that you want, right? In a time of a crisis, you want someone that can turn to the Lord and direct the affairs according to his will and his word. That's That's what I appreciate about this church, that those that are in leadership have a godly mindset when they make decisions. And that, and Hezekiah knows the difference between the Assyrian bragging and trust in the true God who acts for his people. And I just wonder, you know, how many times have you faced an impossible situation where if God didn't act, you were done for? That's the situation that he's in, and the temptation is find some other way or trust in the Lord. What's that? There's that old joke of a guy falls off the cliff and he's hanging onto this little bush and he's yelling up there, "Is anybody up there? Anybody up there?" And he hears a voice out of heaven, "This is the Lord. Let go. I'll catch you. Is there anybody else up there?" and that's not Hezekiah. There is nobody else. Right? There's no plan B. Either God intervenes or they're done. They're lost. And that's the confidence that he puts in. And for the Christian, we know what it looks like when it looks like all is lost. When the very Son of David is defeated and crucified and dead, we know what it's like when, if God doesn't act, all is lost. But God does act, and he's raised from the dead, victorious. And we look at, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, dust you are, and to dust you'll return. But that's not the end of the story, is it? It's dust you'll return, but one day you'll be raised in immortal resurrection life. And Hezekiah is going to see a little inkling of that when the Lord acts in his behalf and defeats Sennacherib. We're going to run out of time, but the short spot of it is, I will draw him out. I will send him back. The Lord said, I will defend this city. He will not shoot one arrow. He will not build a siege works. He will not conquer this city. He'll go back to where he came from. And what we find is at the end of the chapter, an angel of the Lord comes, destroys the army. It's the picture to me is that here's Superman. He has met Kryptonite, and he is going to be defeated. And he goes back to Nineveh. And in fact, Herodotus, the historian, said that in his battle against Egypt, there were mice or rats or something that ate all the bowstrings of his archers. But I wonder, don't they also carry plague? So here, all of a sudden, you can read at the end of the chapter, you know, 100-something thousand soldiers are all destroyed. No battle, no fight that the Lord undertakes and destroys them. And then Sennacherib goes back to Nineveh, and it says in verse 38, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch. Now Hezekiah went to the house of Yahweh, and now Sennacherib goes to the house of Nisroch, his god. Adramelech and Sharezer, his sons, struck him down with the sword. And after they escaped into the hand of Ararat, Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. So all of that talk, what did Pastor Sean say just tonight? the most healthy one. We don't know. And Herod, he's got it all together, defeats all the victories. He goes back and he's put to death by his own sons. Whereas Hezekiah sees the victory of God, that God does deliver his people and keeps them. And that, I'm sorry, that brings us to 8 o'clock. So next week, chapters 38, 39, questions are, who are the main characters? What are the main issues? And how are the issues resolved? Any last word before we close in prayer?
I love the other week when we were talking about the women, and they had their boastfulness, and then it compared to the quiet confidence. And I think about the S guy, he had the self-confidence, but then Hezekiah had the quiet confidence, and he put his confidence with humility to the Lord. And I just think about when I go through something and the despair I feel, and like, God, you've got to save me, you've got to get me out of this. But his was more so defending the Lord's name, and it was focused on how they were mocking him, not how they were mocking the people. And I think that's amazing that he went before the Lord knowing that he could save and praying that he would, but it was such a confident prayer. I think that's what struck me about it that was so special, was glorifying him despite the end of what it could be.
And now let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Do you think you developed that quiet confidence by going through things that you can't solve yourself?
Without a doubt.
Is there an easier way? Tell me, please.
Yeah, right. I haven't figured it out.
So in the meantime, until I can figure that out, the confident trust of Hezekiah is the way to go.
Yeah.
Good. Any last word, or you have to pick up children?
Our God, you are the only true God. You're the living God, the one that hears our cry, sees our need, and acts in your own best interest. And your best interest is our best interest. And we ask that you would take us through the times that would shape us into the people you want us to be. We want the world to know who you are. So act, reveal yourself in a supernatural, powerful way, in us and through us. And for all this, we give you thanks in Jesus' name, the one that died for us and rose again. Thanks be to his name. Amen. God bless you. Thanks for joining. I'll see you again next week.